Jealousy completely challenges our identity and is tied into our self-worth. I'm Alex Orlando. I help people transform, and this is Dating and Authenticity.
Hey everyone, this is Frankie here, and I have Alex here as well. Hey Alex.
Hiya, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good, really good.
Good. You know, it's something to say that we're doing good, given like all the things that are going on. That it's really excellent to focus on you know, things like our topic today, because I personally believe people really need to hear what you bring. So let's get into identity and jealousy.
Sure. Frankie, we're going to take it back. And we're going to take it back to 2009, to when James Cameron released the film Avatar. Obviously a great film, and obviously one that absolutely shaped modern 3D cinema. But what I find really interesting is to look at the parallels to that film versus the parallels to what we're doing in life. So we're going to talk about identity, but before we can really get into identity, we need to focus on the idea that every human being essentially projects what's known as their avatar out into the world. So this avatar is going to be made up of things like their looks, their job, their social status, and essentially the personality traits that they feel comfortable sharing, the personality traits that they want people to see. And of course, as life goes on, as people develop and as situations in life change, this avatar will grow and this avatar will develop. And different people will see a different avatar and a different version of you. So thinking of me personally, the avatar that I show my boss at work will be completely different to the avatar that I show my best friends. The avatar that my best friends see will be completely different to the avatar that any potential partner of mine would see. And of course, the avatar that I had when I was 15 is completely different to the avatar that I had at 30 and will be completely different to the avatar that I have at the age of 45. I kind of think of this as this is basically the gamification of life. And this is what's really known as, this is what's really, I suppose, essential just to get through life on an everyday basis. Because obviously, if we didn't have these characters and we were constantly being really emotional, when we were constantly showing everything about ourselves, human beings would probably struggle to function. So there has to be a degree of gamification, and there has to be a degree of just showing what we want people to see in order for life to progress. But what becomes really, really interesting is when we take a few steps back, we peel away the concept of the avatar, and we actually look at what underpins us as human beings, and we look at what underpins our character and our identity to the real, real core of who we are. So let's go back even further now. And I'm going to introduce you now to the concept of drivers. So drivers are something that's really, really very key to transactional analysis. And transactional analysis is a psychoanalytical theory and method where social transactions are used to determine the ego state of the communication. And if anybody's listened to the radio show before or seen any of my YouTube videos, you'll know that I'm about destroying the ego, and I'm about getting people to being as authentic and as true to themselves as they can be. So with drivers, there's five main drivers that underpin all human beings. So let me just tell you a little bit about each one now. So the first driver that we have is be strong. So this is really, really common with people that you see that have a very strong front. They get things done. They're seen as strong. They're seen as empowered, and they're seen as very confident. But often these people at times don't really connect themselves with their feelings. So these are often the people that seem really composed, really strong on the outside, but are possibly battling quite strong issues, you know, underneath all of that. And I'd probably argue that this is probably the cause of a lot of suicide in men, that theory that they have to be strong and they have to be seen as strong all the time. Then the next driver we have is the hurry up driver. So the hurry up driver is really, really relevant now to modern life, where everything is so fast paced moving. So these are the people that work strong jobs often. Then they're people that come home and they're parents. Then they're the people that go out and they socialize with their friends. So they feel like on the surface, everything's going well, life's progressing, and they're moving really quickly. But because they're moving so quickly, they often neglect their own self-care to a certain extent, but they also tend to lack self-awareness because they're only focusing on what they're doing and they're not reflecting on what's actually going on inside their life at the same time as well. Then we have the try-hard driver. So these are people that consistently try and try they're great friends because most of the time they're happy to do whatever you want to do. So they'll be happy going to a theme park with you. They'll be happy going for a drive with you. They'll be happy playing sport with you. Whatever it is, they're keen to try, and they're keen to try as hard as they can. The downside, when they fail, they feel failure because they feel it twice as strong, because they feel that they've tried as hard as they can. And because that's not been good enough, even though they've tried, it feels like a much stronger sense of failure. So you don't have to be a genius to work out that that's going to be hard for people to be around, because they'll be consistently pushing people away when they have down moments and they don't feel like they've done well. And they'll probably have, underpinning their failures will probably be quite a low sense of self-worth, because they're really going for it and they're really not doing as well as they can. Then we have the be perfect driver. And I think this is the one that you see so much in the millennial generation. So these are the people that you'll often see putting the best pictures of themselves out on social media that they can, where they want to show that they look perfect. They want to show that they have these perfect lives. And people with the be perfect driver too are also really, really creative a lot of the time, because they tend to have a very good sense of detail, and they tend to be very, very aware of what their high standards should be. And they constantly try to live life by these high standards. I spoke about objectification theory a couple of weeks ago. Self-objectification is very real. And obviously being perfect links very strongly with self-objectification. So if you're expecting super, super high standards for yourself and you're failing, that's hard. So people with the be perfect driver are often people that have body image disorders, you know, mental health disorders, because they're constantly striving to be the best that they can, but nothing is ever good enough for themselves. And they often have a very heightened sense of their own self-awareness, which on one hand, great, because it means that they keep going. On the other hand, horrible, because they're consistently judging themselves and consistently falling short of their own expectations. Lastly, we've got the please others driver. So these are people that essentially look at the people in around them, and they decide that their happiness has more meaning than their own happiness. And on one hand, it sounds super noble, super positive, and like a really, really good trait. And to a certain extent, it absolutely is. But often what's going on is this person is living their life waiting for someone to come in their life who has the same driver, who also has the please others driver. When that person doesn't come into their life, often they're left feeling quite disillusioned, quite disenfranchised, and often quite angry with the people that they gave as much as they could do, because they never felt like they had the same effort or same interest put back into them. So these are often the people that suddenly switch. They push people away, they disconnect, and they cut people out of their own lives because they suddenly feel bitter that their own needs hadn't been met. So on one hand, fantastic, really positive trait. On the other hand, not so much. But what I think is really, really key to say now for the purpose of dating and the purposes of relationships is that there's a school of thought that opposites attract. And I think, you know, on an external level, you see that a lot in society. But when we're thinking now of drivers, people with similar drivers are often very attracted to each other. Because if you think about it on a logical level, it makes a lot of sense. It's people with a shared vision. It's people with a shared outlook for life. And it's people that are trying to live their life in the same way. But of course, when something is so similar, two things tend to collide and it tends to implode. And when something implodes, that usually then pulls breakdowns, you know, miscommunication, and often anger and aggression towards each other. So you have two people coming together, each of them with their own identities that they just cannot meet. Then they are literally destroying each other because of their own similarities and the way that they want to live their life. So it's really key for my work now as a coach to actually underpin and get people to understand what it is that's actually driving them and what it is that's actually making them happy. Once they understand that, they can begin to understand their identity and begin to grow and develop from there.
Yeah, that's a lot. Okay, so what came to mind for me is, do most of us have, all or more of, you know, several of those drivers, right? That's one of the things that came to mind for me. And the
Absolutely.
Second thing, okay, well, talk about that.
Well, we're usually made up of, we'll have one core one that we lead to. And then we'll usually have a couple of secondary ones that tend to lead around it. So it's important to say, because just then I sounded very critical and I sounded like all drivers are bad. They're not. On one hand, they're empowering, should be celebrated, and really are key to success. But on the other hand, there's that negative side. So it's about identifying that negative side. And of course, no human being can be one thing all the time. So absolutely, there'll be a range of drivers within there.
Yeah, for sure. What I found about this type of work is that, and the work that you do, is that when you get down to, getting past the ego and really getting to the authentic self, it's having, the power comes from like owning that part of you. So if it's for instance, a driver, you know, it's like we can't just apologize for how we are. It's like saying, well, I apologize because, you know, my eyes are brown. You know, that's not going to make any sense because that is a part of who we are. And it's acknowledging that, you know, the work that you do, right? Like getting to the point where you can actually see that and own it and then have power around it and love that part of yourself, like actually appreciate it and come from that place.
100%. This is when we're now getting into something that my work as a coach is really heavily linked with, and that's self-awareness. And of course, obviously, self-awareness is something that we all think that we have, but the reality is self-awareness is a process. It's a consistent journey, and it's never a destination that you reach, because the journey is changing. You know, just as I spoke about, you have a different avatar, you know, at different periods in your life. You know, your driver will come out in different ways in your life. So on one hand, you can feel completely in check. You can be aware that, look, yes, I do this. Yes, this is a negative trait. Something else comes along, or you're in a relationship with somebody and you move into a different phase. Bang. Suddenly that driver's challenged again. And you have to look at and understand kind of, you know, you have to look back and have that self-awareness and think, look, it's happened again. Why has it happened again? And this is coaching. This is why coaching can be so beneficial to people, because they see it, they understand it. And it's, you know, like we say, it's not just in your relationship, it's in your working life, it's in your friendships, it's in your relationships with your family. And this is, we spoke about this a little bit on Wednesday. This is when you start to realize that often at times the people that irritate you the most are the people that you can see the biggest similarities in yourself. So obviously one of the examples that's given a lot is people with eating disorders tend to be very critical of what other people eat. People with, you know, people that are very bad with money tend to be very critical of other people that are bad with money and spend too much. So once you have that self-awareness and you can see that and you can recognize that, you begin to understand yourself a lot more, and relationships with people become a lot easier too.
Right. I imagine if someone, like say for instance, two people who have the please others drivers, right? And they go out and they start dating and they're like, this is so great because the previous relationship, I wasn't appreciated for pleasing others. And then that comes from the negative place. And so if two people are coming together from a place of negativity or something that didn't work, while it seems great on the surface, at some point it's going to run out. It's going to run out of gas. You know?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think if you know, in terms of the drivers, the idea of two people with a please others driver coming together sounds so compatible. They both want to please each other. But think about that just in a common term in a relationship with somebody. That's when you get that scenario where one person's like, where do you want to go for dinner tonight? And then the other person goes, I don't know, where do you want to go? And then you say, I don't know, where should we go? And you just never get there because you're both consistently deciding, you know, or consistently deciding that what the other person wants is more important. And of course, that's a really small decision. But that's a decision that then amplifies into all other aspects of your life too, and all other aspects of your relationship as well. So that question about where should we eat becomes a much, much, much bigger question. And neither of you are making that decision. And then subconsciously, because you both feel like at the same time you're trying to make the other person happier, you're beginning to feel resentment for that other person because you're putting your happiness down at the expense of that other person. So then the relationship started with two positive people destined and determined to make the other person happy. And it's now become two people that are inherently miserable and slightly bitter towards the other person because neither of them feel like their own needs or their own happiness requirements have been met.
Right. Nobody's happy. Oh, man. That's a lot. Okay. So, how does this tie into identity and jealousy?
Well, I think so much of the way we behave is going to be driven by these drivers. So that's a huge part of our identity. But another thing that I need to touch on now regarding identity is something that I have seen with clients a lot, and I have seen in the real world too. And it's something that I've named story theory. And what I mean when I say story theory is this idea that everything that we do in life needs to have a completion point. So that will be really minor things. So you're hungry. That's a story. You eat, you're no longer hungry. Story completed. You're thirsty. You grab a glass of water, you're no longer thirsty, you've drunk, you've had a drink, done. Then there's, you know, like mid-level stories, like I need to provide for my family. You go to work, you get your monthly paycheck, you pay for your family, story completed for that month. But of course, we have these huge stories in life, these absolutely monumental stories in life. I've said it in a couple of my videos before that within the first 3 to 5 years, you're instantly deciding what you want in a relationship, and you're instantly deciding what the desirable characteristics are in a relationship. So if you're a son, you're looking at your father and you're thinking, does he have positive characteristics that I can embody? If you're a daughter, you're looking at your mother and you're thinking, does she have positive characteristics that I can embody? And you're also looking at the gender of whatever you're attracted to, and you're trying to decide whether those are positive traits that you would want in a potential partner. So if you're attracted to women, you're looking at your mother and you're deciding whether she's got things that you would want in a potential partner. If you're attracted to men, then you're looking at your father and you're just trying to decide whether he has things that you would be attracted to in a potential partner. Of course, you don't realize that you're doing it because you're that age, but this is something that's obviously being intrinsically built up as we grow older and older and older. So we have that, but then also working alongside that is we have the other side of the story. And this is when we get into huge, huge, huge stories. So let's think about now a guy who grows up without a father in his life, or he has a father who he's potentially very distant from. So perhaps he realizes at some point that he holds a lot of aggression towards men. Then he realizes that when he's around big groups of men, he begins to feel emasculated. So maybe he tries to find a way to act up. He tries to find a way to deal with that. Maybe he tries to find a way to be the alpha. And possibly because he's not had what he sees as an alpha figure in his life, he then tries to become that alpha figure. So maybe that doesn't work. So then he looks for what he could deem to be a role model or a male role model in his life. He can't find that. So then he does something in his head where he creates what I call a self-created dad. And this self-created dad is something that he plays off in his head, who is telling him what he should be doing, telling him how he should be behaving, and telling him what he should be doing. So possibly, maybe this self-created dad is saying, you do not stop until you earn X amount of money. Only then will you be successful. Or perhaps this dad is created as a result because his dad left his mother for another woman. So this dad is saying in his head, you sleep around, you're promiscuous, you're with lots of women. So then he starts embodying that or doing that as a behavior. Or possibly he just keeps going because he doesn't know quite what it is. So he's essentially acting his life out based on what this self-created in his head father figure is telling him to do. And of course, this is normal. We all do things like this to a certain extent anyway. But underpinning this huge story that he's created in his head will be a set of beliefs, ideologies, and values which may create false expectations for life and then lead to feelings of frustration and happiness throughout life. And when you think about that, that's hard, because that's a story that you're never going to complete. And I firmly believe that we all need to complete stories on our head in order to move on. And there's a lot of talk in the world of personal development about being complete, closure. And I think that just really shows just how much we need that feeling of closure, how much we need that feeling of completion in order to progress. So on one hand, we have these really easy stories to complete, but then on the other hand, we have these huge stories to complete that we don't even realize are there for us, and we're constantly playing out. And then, of course, within those big stories, we've got other little stories too. So think about the guy that I just described who grew up without a father figure. He's going to have a hard time if he has a male manager at work. He's going to have a hard time relating to women because he hasn't had a father show him how to do it. There's going to be so many things underpinning his life, so many sub-stories within that big story, that it's just going to be a consistent struggle. So for me personally, if I was to coach someone on that, or had that kind of, who had that issue or had those feelings, it would be about getting him to recognize that this isn't a story that he needs to play out. This isn't a story that he needs to underpin his identity. This isn't a story that should dictate his identity. But of course, to realize that, to see those stories, you have to have the self-awareness to really see what's going on. And you have to have the self-awareness to really understand that you're playing a part in this story. And I spoke about it, of course, again, a few weeks about too. The human mind is very melancholic. So it automatically draws to the negative and it draws to the struggles. But on the other hand, too, the human mind is also very egotistical. So it automatically sees itself as the main star and automatically thinks that everybody else is seeing this main story. So there's some work in coaching to do in order to close the story, separate the consistent pressure of being the star in the story, and then just moving on to a point of happiness away from that.
I know somebody like that. I knew someone like that when you were starting to describe, and I didn't know you were going to talk about this, so it's pretty awesome. When you started to describe this person, you know, this male that grew up without a father and all the things that happened after that, it's so incredible. It's so, I'm like, that's exactly what happened. that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. You know, he had trouble with, you know, male managers, with male, you know, kind of authority, or someone who occurred as being an authority. And that's pretty fascinating. It is, it happens all the time. And if someone, I feel, and I know we agree, because we kind of met in the context of a transformational space, right? So
sure.
I feel that this is something, even though we identify it and we understand it about ourselves, and we're able to get our ego to step aside, you know, for a while, if we don't continue to do the work on an ongoing basis, it's just going to come back. It's like what you focus on is what you get. And we feel great for, you know, having a huge breakthrough, and then things start to shift and transform. And it's a constant, you know, checking in and being accountable to someone. It could be, you know, someone who is a coach like you. It could be a colleague who has gone through some of the work that you've gone through as well. But it's an ongoing thing. It's not like we're ever that, you know, because there's nothing wrong with us. We have things that happen, and then we act accordingly, right? Like an avatar, we take these things on. So it's, you know, important to realize this is what we do and this is why we do it. And it's appropriate to feel that way and to act that way. And there's no power in that. So how am I going to get to the power in myself, which is like, you know, having the identity and the, you know, the ego aside and really getting to the authentic self.
Well, I mean, the reason I focused so heavily on at the start of this, the story theory and the drivers, is just because I'm all about, you know, authenticity, as you know, and I'm all about people connecting with their real selves. And it's so key to do that, to really separate yourself from your story, to separate yourself from the negative side of your driver. And it's hard because these stories that I discussed and these things that are shaping our identity are starting from such an early age. You know, I'll give you another common story that you see a lot too. If you think of a woman that you know who's what you would think of as being conventionally very, very, very attractive, right? She would have started school, or possibly even before she started school, and people would have said that she was a pretty girl. People would have said that she was an attractive girl. People would have made those kind of comments about, oh, when she grows up, she's going to be a real, real heartbreaker. So already from a really, 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 really early age, her identity is being built up as an attractive girl. And then as she grows up, she becomes an attractive woman. And this is what she feels that she is. So her identity, despite the fact she's not chosen it, despite the fact she's not decided to embody it, her identity is, you are an attractive woman. And on one hand, that's great. That's fantastic. You know, she's got something really going for her, something that she can really explore and have a great time in life. On the other hand, is that really a true representation of who she is? Is that really a representation of what she's achieving in the world? No, because this woman's probably capable of doing so much more. This woman's probably capable of showing so much more. Problem is, if you combine that story and you possibly combine it with, say, the be perfect driver, that's a recipe for disaster to a certain level, because she's going to continue to grow up. She's going to continue to get older, and she's never going to be happy, because she might feel attractive because she's been told she's attractive, but she's never going to be attractive enough. So she's going to be unhappy. She's going to be objectifying herself all the time. And you just think, she's had no power in that. She's had absolutely no power in making that decision. And that's just a really, really hard narrative for someone to have. And, you know, that's a very obvious example to go to, but there'll be countless others. So the work really comes in the personal development side of things, in terms of separating yourself away from that, so you can actually be truly happy.
A lot of freedom in that, like, oh wow, I don't have to be pretty today. Phew, thank goodness.
Yeah, it's a liberation of sorts, isn't it? It's a liberation, because you're being free of what you thought mattered and realizing that actually it doesn't matter in the way that you did before.
Right, and you know, God forbid that you're not that one day, whether it's pretty or powerful or positive, all these things that we take
or even God hope not, the man that you're attracted to or the man that you're with finds somebody else more attractive than you, or tells you that someone else is attractive. How's that going to make you react? Your drive is being challenged and your life story is being challenged as well.
Yeah, I would be insanely jealous. I had to throw that in because that's the topic.
Of course, well, of course. I feel we're segueing towards that now anyway.
Oh, wow, that's incredible. Oh, man. And you know what's interesting and what I've discovered in my own personal development and in the personal development of others, because that's kind of those are the people and that's kind of the world I like to hang out in, obviously, is that we think that's the truth. We think this is how it is. This is the truth. I'm pretty, I'm using your example, I'm pretty, and if I have to be pretty, because if I'm not pretty, I'm not going to be successful. No one's going to love me. My dad's not going to like take me to, you know, whatever, you know. So we think that's actually the truth. And when you finally get to a point where you're like, okay, something is not working to the degree that you're just like, I need something to, I'm not okay. And we're all okay, but we get to that point where something is not working to such a massive degree, and then we start to do the work, and then we're like, oh my God, that's not the truth. Wow, I'm actually something else. I'm actually, I can separate, like you were saying, separate that from who I really am, and just now spend some time looking and discovering and coming from, you know, my authentic self. That's such an amazing process. That's such an amazing, you know,
shift. Of course. Mm-hmm. But it's the more you think about it too, the more you realize how much there is that makes that a challenge. So with every, you know, with everything that bothers you in life, or with everything that shapes the way you act or shapes the way you react to things, it's going to be underpinned by a personal belief, a societal belief, meaning a belief that's come from society and the world around us, or a moral belief. So that'll probably be something that's come from your upbringing, or possibly something that's maybe come from your religious faith, if you have that, you know, just something along those lines. But you know, you're hearing those things and you're getting these messages and you're thinking that this is the way I should behave or this is the way that I should act. But the problem is not a lot of that is actually coming from who you authentically are. And this is when we talk about authenticity versus identity. And we're thinking, so we have an avatar, sure, and we'll have different ways that our identity is portrayed, and we'll have different things that make up our identity. But when you actually step aside, you look at it and you think, what percentage of the day, or how many thoughts do I have per day that are actually truly authentically mine? And that's quite a powerful thing to think about, because we know that human beings have over 45,000 thoughts per day, but we also know that over 90% of those thoughts are exactly the same as well. That's crazy. So it could be, you know, nearly 30 something thousand thoughts a day you're having that haven't necessarily come authentically from your own place.
Right. Well, and then, to that point, we had a really interesting question come in. I'm gonna play that right now.
Sure.
My question is, why do people judge others based on appearance alone so quickly?
People judge others so quickly because it's the first thing that people see. It's absolutely the first thing that people see. And of course, linking in with that, different, you know, your appearance is a projection of the way that you look, or your appearance is a projection a lot in terms of the way that you are. So you may look a certain way and you look that certain way because you want to look that way, or you may look that certain way because you think that's relevant to where you're at in life. You know, like I spoke about with the avatar consistently changing and adapting based on who you are and as you get older. But people are judging you based on their own interpretation of a certain look, or people are judging you based on their own interpretation of what they see. So, for example, I'll give you a really trivial example. I'm a guy with long hair. People have asked me if I'm a vegan. People have asked me if I do yoga. People have asked me if I listen to heavy metal. People have asked me if I'm a grunger. People have asked me if I used to be a goth when I was younger. None of those things are true, right? Absolutely none of those things are true. But people are seeing one thing, and that's what they're fixating on. They go straight to that. And the reason it's so easy to do that, and the reason it's so easy to make that judgment, is it's because it's the first thing that you see in front of you. So that is a very, very long roundabout answer to that question. But the easier it is to judge something, the quicker you'll make that judgment.
Well, I still think what I'm interested to know, this woman, I'm interested to know, like, is she making that judgment of herself? Like, how does that person, I mean, people have actually asked you, are you vegan or, you know, all these other things, right? But I think
yeah.
a lot of times our, you know, someone looks at us a certain way and we think they're judging us, which they may be, but our interpretation is our own interpretation of ourselves if that person's not said a word to us. So
absolutely, yeah. And obviously, of course, it's judgment is judgment's also about survival too. You know, in life, you do have to think, you know, you see a person and you think, is this someone that I feel safe around? Is this someone that I can trust? And it's really, really interesting, just to give a very, very different segue to that question. But online dating, right? Men think that it's about choosing a photo where you look as handsome as you can, as successful as you can, and as wealthy as you can. The research says, sure, look as attractive as you can. But what women are really looking for in a picture of you on a dating app is how trustworthy you look and how smart you look. So think about that. We're making judgments on what we think we should be, and people are judging us on what they think we should be. And just in that trivial example that I gave, yes, there's some overlap, yes, there's some similarities, but fundamentally, they're not really the same thing.
Right, they're not. Huh. And, you know, smart is different, means different things to different women, right? So it might be smart about this, or smart emotionally, or, you know, all these variables.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Or smart could even just mean how are you dressed.
Mm-hmm.
Smart could just mean, you know, there's statistics on dating apps that men that post a picture of themselves with a dog have a much higher success rate. I can't remember what the percentage is. It's fairly significant. But you think a woman's just looking at a picture of a guy with a dog and thinking, he probably looks trustworthy because he's, you know, nurturing an animal, and he probably looks smart because he's emotionally intelligent enough to support that animal. But what she may not realize is that guy's just said to one of his best friends, can I borrow your dog for this picture? Or this guy, you know, it could be his dog at his parents' house that he sees twice a year when he goes home for Christmas and birthdays. There's so many things at play that you don't realize, but we're all consistently making these judgments.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And we know, you know, I know that you personally don't, you know, you tell your clients not to go dating online because you're interested in them really having a real connection with people in a quick way. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, dating apps is an algorithm. It's a gamification. So you're swiping through in the same way. I mean, dating apps use the same algorithms that online multiplayer games use. So the purpose is not necessarily subscribed to two people really having a really strong connection. The purpose is instead just about showing people as many people as they can. And, you know, on one hand, that's fine. On one hand, you know, that is life. You walk past people, you decide whether you find them attractive. Sure. But on the other hand, it's for guys that have a lot to offer, for women that are so much more than their looks, it doesn't. It sells them short because they're not really, they're showing maybe 5-10% of who they are. And it's that full 90%, which is what they should be being judged on, because it's that full 90%, which is the amazing aspect of their character. It's that 90%, which is the amazing aspect of their personality.
Mm. And to be fair, we know people it's worked for them. I wonder how they did it. We should have them on the show and talk about it. Well, let's see. So we have another question that someone had sent in, but I had a little technical difficulty with it. He said that he was texting or messaging with a woman and it was going really great. And then he got to a point where he actually asked her to meet and she disappeared. And he's like, what happened? Actually, he said, why do women do that? anyway, that's the question.
Why do women agree to make plans with you and then not turn up? Or why do people do that in general?
Yeah, like, you know, have all this really great banter in the messaging. And then when it comes down to actually meeting, disappearing.
Again, there's so many things at play. There's honestly an awful lot of things at play. So, you know, I think, so we're thinking again of identity. Some people, you know, meeting new people, socializing with new people, being very in the moment, being very impulsive is very natural to them. So, you know, they can speak to someone on a dating app, speak to someone on a dating website, and they feel super comfortable to go and meet up with that person. They don't have the nerves. They don't have the reservations around it. And they don't have some of the considerations that other people would have around it too. But for some people, that's not necessarily part of who they are. You know, dating for some people can be incredibly nerve-wracking. You know, there's a lot of women that need time to plan what they're going to wear for a date. You wouldn't necessarily believe it, but you hear stories of it. There's also a lot of people that need almost like a Goldilocks scenario to feel comfortable going on a date with that person. So, you know, you hear stories of people doing a screening check almost. So they look at that person's Facebook, they look at that person's Instagram, they look at that person's LinkedIn, and they really try and get a full understanding of that person. So possibly in this particular case, if we're thinking of a specific scenario, maybe this guy experienced that. Maybe she did a full bit of research to find out who he was. Maybe she saw him on Facebook and she thought, actually, there's something that I don't necessarily like about this. And people, when they're, you know, when they're communicating who they are via, you know, via banter across dating apps, it's not always a reflection of who they are. And it's, again, you know, we talk about it too. Dating apps is a technique. And for some people, the technique may work. And for some people, you may be able to use certain techniques, use certain openers, use certain conversation topics. And that does segue into dates with them. But for other people, the technique may not work and they may need to generally feel the connection. So it's possible in this particular case, the banter was great. The conversation flowed, but the connection didn't feel like it was underneath and it didn't feel like it was there. So the day of the date's come possibly, or maybe the day before the date's come, and this woman's just thought, actually, I don't think it's there. I don't think it's right for me to go. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's perfectly normal to do that. And I think it's understandable because there's so many considerations that we have to think of in the dating world. And there's so many considerations that we have to think about in terms of going through life in general. You know, there's a term called heuristics, and heuristics are, they're basically what you think of as rules of thumb. They're rules of thumb that you live your life by, and they're going to be different for everybody. So it's possible in this particular case with these two people, maybe he just did something that didn't sit within one of those rules of thumb. Maybe he made a comment that strayed slightly too much into the territory and made her feel slightly sexually uncomfortable. You don't know, but it is really worthwhile to say that, you know, when I hear questions like these, I understand them to a certain extent. I really do. But I also think there's a degree of entitlement in terms of, I made plans with this woman and she's cancelled. Now I don't get the date. But maybe what you should actually be thinking about is, you know, what were these women's needs? Did I meet them? Was I right for her? And if the answer is no, and you were authentically yourself, there's absolutely no shame in saying, look, we just weren't right for each other. We just figured it out earlier on.
And another way to look at it is she was bored and, you know, he kept her company and it was fun, but it wasn't something that, you know, she actually
absolutely
wanted to do. I mean, whether it's on a dating app or in social media, you know, there are conversations that get started up that and saying,
Sure.
And then it's just.
And just to give you something else within that too, you know, I hear a lot of men say that women use dating apps for validation. And there may be elements of that. In fact, there's definitely elements of that. But what these men don't understand is that men do it too. And the science backs up that men with narcissistic personality types are drawn to dating apps because they can consistently get validation. So it frustrates me when I hear men shift all the blame and criticize the women for it, because they're doing the same thing. And this is one of the inauthenticities behind dating apps. This is one of the inauthenticities behind dating sites. You don't know what two people's intentions are when they're speaking for the first time. But if you send someone a message going, hey, how are you doing? I'm just going to talk to you for validation for a couple of days. No one's going to reply. So you're playing this long, elaborate game as to who can get the other one to meet up. And, you know, it's just, there's so many things at play that you don't realize are actually going on.
Right. And to one of your points is how we mirror one another, right?
Absolutely.
How something in someone else is kind of the thing about yourself that you're not, that you struggle with or whatever. There's a term that I've learned, and it's, there's nobody out there. So when you're feeling like that person did this or that, it's like, there's nobody out there. It's over here, you know, that is actually occurring.
Absolutely.
Well, awesome. Let's see. We have another question. Let's see. Where is it? Why is it that men seem to be more angry and frustrated in today's world? Are they struggling to find their place and resisting being authentic to try and protect the old masculine ways? Whoa.
That's a big question. That's a show in itself. That is okay. So just to just to give an overview as to what I would hear behind that question, yes, I do think men are frustrated. And I think men are frustrated because they possibly don't realize it. And what I mean by that is, you know, at the start, I started with the be strong driver. And I think there's a lot of truth in terms of men possibly not being open to saying, look, I feel insecure about this. Because there are a lot of pressures in the world, both for men and both for women. And I think often men at times don't want to acknowledge those pressures are there. So they'll just say, look, I'm doing well, I'm successful. And then because they feel like they're successful, they feel frustrated when they don't get the results that they think they should get. So there's an element of frustration because of that and not really wanting to quite face up to their own insecurities and their own things that they're really trying to identify. But the other thing that I think is really, really true to say too is as feminism has got stronger and as feminism has got pushed a lot more, you know, there are a lot of men that can't understand it, and there are a lot of other men, there are a lot of men that don't quite understand the concept of it. So, you know, feminism isn't about women's rights. Feminism is about equal rights to both men and women. And that message is one that gets lost in translation from both sides. It absolutely does. And sometimes men don't have the self-awareness to actually reflect and think about what feminism could actually mean. And then you have the other side to it of when something is seen as being really extreme. So when men look at feminism and see it as, you know, a majority, or they look at feminism and think all women are feminists, what happens is you then get the opposite side to that. So there's movements online, there's movements on subcommittees now online and subcommunities where they're the opposite of feminism. They're about, you know, the society has let men down, so we're going to act up and we're going to fight society back. So then you have two genders completely at war with each other that can't quite meet in the middle. And that's a problem. But it's a problem that can be very much resolved with honest and frank communication. But you have to get both people to step away from their own stories, as we've spoken about. And we also have to get both people to separate from their own identity. So men are frustrated because they don't necessarily feel heard and understood. And women are frustrated as well because they feel that that's the message that they've been taking throughout society as well. So it's a really strong, huge topic. And it's a real strong case of two agendas against each other. But that would be my overview to that question.
Excellent. And I encourage anyone who has questions and wants to talk to Alex personally, his website is alexorlando.coach, and all his Instagram and all his content is there. And tell us about you're doing a promo right now, yes?
Yep, I'm still doing the free 30-minute consultation just to basically an initial chat, just to see how we get on and to see what your relationship and life goals are, and then to see if we can be compatible in terms of making those happen.
Great. Well, I've personally referred people to you and who have been just singing your praises, and you know, their lives have really shifted and they're having breakthroughs in different areas, just dating, but you know, work and stuff. So
I think something that it's really relevant to say now, and something that completely just links in to what we've spoken about too, in terms of, you know, I consider myself to have really good self-awareness. Self-awareness is definitely something that I've practiced a lot and studied and tried to understand as much as I can as I've got older. But, you know, a couple of years ago, I was asked what my biggest fear was, and I couldn't even remember the answer that I gave because it just, you know, it probably was so inconsequential to everything else. I realize now that my biggest fear is living an unfulfilled life. And something that I've realized that gives me so much fulfillment is, you know, sharing content like this, understanding content like this, having breakthroughs with clients, engaging with clients, hearing their stories, getting them to understand their stories, changing perspectives, reframing perspectives, everything that goes in that. And I realize now that once I'm on that path and I'm working towards that, and we're, you know, I'm seeing people getting fulfilled and I'm experiencing that fulfillment with them, it just makes me realize how much what I thought mattered in my identity didn't matter anything much as I did. And I think that's really inspiring. And for me, that's been so liberating to see that. And it's been so liberating to feel that.
Absolutely. Oh, we had an inquiry about, it's a new relationship, and one of the partners is jealous of the other partner's number of sexual partners previous to the relationship. How do they deal with that?
So the question surrounding previous number of sexual partners is a fascinating one, because there's so many different ways that you can tackle it. You either never discuss it, you decide it doesn't matter, you say your business before me was your business before me, my business before you was my business before you. But of course, often it's hard, because you instinctively wonder and you instinctively speculate. You know, this is why the media business is so successful, because people speculate and people constantly want a source for their speculation. But what's interesting within this question is to think about what it really means. What does the amount of sexual partners that someone's had actually mean to you? Because it shouldn't necessarily actually mean that much, because, you know, you're talking about people that haven't known each other their whole life. You're talking about people that have gone through different periods in their life of different life experiences. Different life experiences accompany different relationships with sex, and that's something that should be acknowledged. And I also think people have different expectations for the way genders should behave in sex. And I know we spoke about this last week, and I am completely, completely against that. I'm absolutely against that. You know, people are adults, people can make their decisions, and people can have sex with whoever they want to have sex with, as long as someone doesn't get hurt. And I think there has to be an understanding of that, and I think there has to be an acknowledgement of that. The only time I think it really should become an issue is when there's a moral dilemma at play. So possibly someone who has a religious background, who doesn't possibly believe in sex before marriage, or doesn't believe in promiscuous sex, then being someone who doesn't share that same belief. But that for me isn't a reflection of a problem being between the two sexual partners. That's a difference between a moral. That's a different moral value. And that's fine. Possibly you can speak about it. Possibly both people can try and understand what the other one's thinking or what the other one's feeling. But the conversation is around that. The conversation is around changing and understanding that. The conversation is not around lashing out at that person. And this is the issue with jealousy as an emotion. Jealousy is an emotion that can creep up on you and you don't even necessarily realize it's there. And it just gets stronger, 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 bigger, 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 bigger. And then suddenly you react because you feel pushed, or suddenly you react because something triggers you and pushes you over the edge. So in order to prevent that, there has to be a conversation first about the difference in the moral values or the difference in the way that the two of you behaved. But should it matter the amount of sexual partners that someone's had before you? Probably not. And I think you're tying your own self-worth up in that too. So, you know, men want to be the best partner that they've ever been to the other person. And part of that will be about being the best in bed that that person's ever been with, giving that person the best amount of sex that they've ever had. But really, when all's said and done, is that something that you should dwell on? Is that something you should reflect on? It's something that you should maybe try and do for the other person because you love that person, because you care for that person, or because the two of you have agreed that sex will be a key part of what you're doing and you should want to see the other person satisfied and fulfilled from it. But tying your identity up and lashing out at someone for something that they've done before you is not something that's worth doing in any way, shape or form.
Yeah, there's no happiness that comes from, you know, the past, and there's only stress looking too far in the future because we don't even know. And it's just, you know, and also just, you know, women, we release, you know, we have a chemical reaction. We have, you know, oxytocin kind of going off when we're connecting in a physical way with a man. And so I could see how, I mean, that's a whole other thing, but, you know, maybe, you know, if from the woman's perspective, you know, feeling like, well, you know, the men, you know, he has to really loved her, you know, he's loved all those women just because a woman can, because of this chemical reaction, actually connect emotionally to a partner where men don't have that. So,
yeah. And I was just thinking of what you've said there. I would also query the mental state of a man, to be honest, because if he wants his partner who he loves, cares for and loves being with and wants to see happy, he should want her to have been happy in their life before they met him. So do you really want to sit and wish that that person's had horrible sex, painful sex? I don't think you should. I don't think that's right. And I don't think that's fair. So maybe the work in the jealousy with this question is about changing it, reframing it, and just thinking, look, I care for this person. I want this person to have been happy, regardless of whether that was with me or without me.
Sure. So complicated, though.
I mean, you're talking with something like that, you're talking about an idyllic state, which is so hard to get to and such a long process to get to. But it's a process and a state that if you get to, you'll absolutely feel liberated away from previous insecurities that seemed huge at the time and now don't.
Mm-hmm. It's again, going back to, you know, dating and relationships and authenticity, it's actually getting yourself to a place where you're confident enough to be able to bring that kind of love and care to a partnership because you have it for yourself. Like you can't give away what you don't have, right? Like if you don't have it, you can't give it away. And if you think, you know, it's missing over there with your partner, it's because it's missing over here with you. So get that for yourself before you can actually go and be brave enough and have the courage to have these conversations with another person and create something powerful.
Yeah. I mean, it also comes back to what we said at the start regarding story. If you want to make a story out of your partner's past before you, sure, you can do. But it's probably not something that's going to necessarily make you happy or make the relationship better or beneficial in the long run either.
Mm-hmm. We have another question. My new boyfriend seems to want to make me jealous. It could be about, you know, women friends, and it could be about just women in general. What should I do?
That's definitely a conversation to be had. But first of all, you need to understand what you felt he was doing in order to make you jealous, because if you're hearing that question or you're, you know, that's a question that you have, you obviously feel jealous. So the first question is what he's doing a cause to make me feel jealous? If it's not, then there's potentially some work around why you feel jealous. There's potentially some work about identifying where these jealous triggers come from. If that's not the case, and he is genuinely trying to make you jealous, and he is trying to, what's known as gaslight an idea in your head, or gaslight an idea in your head that he could leave you at any point for this woman, then that's completely from his own insecurity. That is completely from his lack of self-worth, because this is probably a story that he's playing out from really early in his childhood, or really early in his adult life, that he only feels loved when he sees people reacting. He only feels loved when he sees people getting jealous or fighting for him. And that's not a healthy story to have in life at all. And that's absolutely a terrible and unhealthy story to have in a relationship as well. And if that's the case, there's conversations to be had around it. Maybe he's got things that he needs to share that have made him that, or maybe it's just generally a case that he is not ready for a relationship. He is not the right person for what you want in a relationship at that time. It's a huge topic, and it's one that in this particular case with this particular question, it's one that needs to be reflected on, because that is absolutely a thing that people do. It is absolutely a thing that people do. And it's about a lack of self-worth. And rather than dealing with that self-worth, you try and use power. So you try and give yourself power and status over that person. And one of the best ways to prove that you have power, one of the best ways to prove that you have status over that person is to see them react, is to see them jealous, is to see them fighting over you. But of course, that's not healthy. That's not real love. That's not real self-love. And that's not a real relationship either.
Yeah, it does become when one partner in particular tends to be jealous, it does become a bit of a power play.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, you know, I think you had talked about entitlement in one of our conversations, like feeling entitled because you have this certain place in this person's life. So you're entitled to have the other person behave a certain way that satisfies that entitlement or speaks to that and solves
it. It's ego versus ego. You know, you're into a Game of Thrones style battle as to who can come out as, you know, who can come out on top, who can sit on the relationship throne. And you're never going to be happy because you're going to constantly be at war with each other.
No, it's not. I can't imagine there's any satisfaction. I mean, you know,
momentary. Yeah, it's a short-term payoff, isn't it? The short-term payoff comes in that person reacting, but there's no longer-term payoff because the relationship's not going to evolve, and in fact, the relationship's probably going to combust as it does it as well. But also, it's not an authentic battle. It's ego versus ego. It's not two people that care for each other fighting. It's two people's egos fighting against each other, and one ego can never win because when an ego's beaten, it just comes back stronger with something else or seeks something else to feed the ego too.
So someone's going to die.
And then they're going to take that. The relationship will die.
Well, yeah, but then, you know, So if you don't get that resolved, you don't even understand what the heck happened, and then you go into the next relationship with this Game of Thrones mentality, it's just one more disaster, one more slaughter waiting to be had.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Wow. These are great questions. Really good questions. We're kind of, you know, winding down here. I know we could talk for a long time on this. Just switching things up a little bit, what are we talking about next week?
So next week's going to be a very different topic. Next week we're going to look at the idea of romance, because romance is a fascinating thing. You know, on one hand, we're told that romance is something we should strive for. You know, we see it in films, romantic comedies, romantic dramas, period romance dramas. But then on the other hand, how many people really feel like romance is something that they have in their everyday life? And I think it's a really good question to have, to actually define what romance is. You know, what is romantic to you? Because obviously, Frankie, you'll have a very different idea of what feels romantic to what I do in terms of what feels romantic. So there's some really interesting conversations and some really interesting theory and research behind what romance means, why we should be romantic, how we communicate our love for someone, and how that love really turns into a romantic gesture or a romantic relationship.
That's going to be great. I'm looking forward to that. And thank you, because it was an inquiry that a woman friend of mine had. And when I brought it to you, you were like, let's do it. So
Definitely.
So if anybody has any questions, you know, reach out to us. All our contact information is on, you know, our show page, and you can reach Alex if you want to have your consultation with him. It's, you know, 30 minutes well spent at alexorlando.coach. And is there anything else? What do you want to leave your listeners with this week, Alex?
I have to be honest and say I didn't actually prepare anything off the top of my head, because I think this topic is so broad. There's so many things I would like people to take away with them. I think what I would really encourage people to think about, though, is the idea of stories that I spoke about. And I'd really encourage people to look at the stories that they played out consistently in their life, because number one, it's fascinating. But number two, you'll actually probably realize that there's things that you've done or there's things that you felt from previous stories in your life that you don't need to feel and you shouldn't feel any longer. And I think, you know, if one person does that, hears that, for me, that's brilliant, because that's going to be a person that's going to be teeing themselves up for a much more fulfilling life as well. So now I think I always want people, whenever they listen to my shows and in the time in between, just to have a little bit of self-reflection, because self-reflection is going to be so much what underpins personal development.
Yes, definitely. Well, an hour went by really quickly, and I want to thank everybody for listening. And you can, on the same link, if you have it, you can download it and you can listen to it, you know, whenever you like, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah. Thanks, Frankie. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you. Bye.